All right.
This is an oral history with Lamar Bunn on September 2nd, 2008 at Lewis Clark Studios in Raleigh. And I'd like to start off with our first standard question. Tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got interested in landscape architecture.
Well, I'm from Raleigh. I went to Broughton High School and got interested in architecture. My father had always been a drawer and a builder, and my grandfather had, so I was always interested in construction and drawing. So I took a lot of drafting in high school and got very interested in it. And I wanted to be an aeronautical designer, but NC State did not have aeronautical design as a curriculum. They had engineering, but I didn't want the engineering. We couldn't afford to send me anywhere except State. So I signed up for the architectural school and luckily got in. And in fact, Milton Small's son, G. Milton Small Jr., the third, and I were roommates the first semester at NC State. We'd been good friends in high school. So I went to NC State in architecture.
What year was that?
It was 1961.
What was the school like in 1961?
Scary.
How was it scary?
Well, it was Dean Camp Hefner was there, and he had a large presence. And because you were working so closely with your professors and you got to know them on a first name basis, it was it became less scary. It became much more intimate. But being of like one out of 373 students, freshman students, at that time I don't think there was more than 500 students in the, I'm sorry, there was 300 and some in the whole school, and we had a freshman class of 173. And as you found out the first semester on campus, it is that the School of Design students were kind of looked at in a different way than all the other students, in as much as that the professors in other curriculums and other classes you had to take would cut you a little more slack because they understood what you were going to go through, even though at the time as a freshman we had no idea what we were going to go through.
Was it the hours that you had to put in on
yeah,
the projects?
Yeah, it was working so many hours in the on the projects, and you would have I think freshman year we had three classes in the School of Design. One was a drawing class that was freehand drawing that was taught either by George Berline or Joe Cox, and then you had a design studio, and you had a technical drafting studio. I've got to talk the design studio for me. It was a product design gentleman from Germany, who his interest was in photography. And Brian Shawcroft taught me in my freshman technical drawing class. And Joe Cox taught me in the drawing class.
And that was your first semester?
First semester.
So, not going from semester to semester, but what were some of the projects that you started working on as a student? What were some of the assignments?
Well, the first year, that whole year was made up in design studio of basically breaking down your prejudices of what you had brought into the school, looking at rubber bands differently than just rubber bands, looking at paper different than paper, learning to fold paper so it became structurally supported. When you dropped an ink, a squirt of ink from 10 feet, what did it make on the floor? And from 20 feet, what did it make? Just exploring all kinds of the mediums that you had available to you, and stretching your deposit of knowledge on these items. You really didn't have a project as such. I guess the biggest project we had was we had to take one of Brian Shawcross' homes and do an isometric drawing of the components of it structurally, without the sheetrock and without the siding on and everything, and doing ink, which at that time we were using ruling pens, where you had to fill the little pen up with ink, and you had to adjust the little knob on the ink pen to get finer lines or broader lines. I'd say that. And towards the end of the first year, we actually had to design a building, any kind of building we wanted to design. We had to design a floor plan and elevations of it and draw a perspective of it. I remember we had a Cuban guy in the class who was probably 35 years old. He had just immigrated in from Cuba, and he was an architect in Cuba. And we were all just amazed at his building that he designed, which was much more sophisticated than our little amateurish suite's catalog put together stuff. And then we moved into second year. Second year was a little bit different because the first 2 years everybody took the same courses, where you were in architecture, landscape architecture, product design. But in second year, you had to take a semester of landscape architecture. And most of the architects didn't have any idea what landscape architecture was, and neither did I. So second semester I was assigned a landscape architectural studio, and Lewis Clark happened to be my professor. And that's where I first met Lewis, and where I became faced with landscape architecture, and where I fell in love with it. And it was during that semester I decided to transfer to landscape architecture out of architecture. And
were there some other students that did that same thing?
There may have been one or two, but there were a lot of students that were there precisely for landscape architecture. One of my best friends was Fred Stressoff Jr. from Fort Lauderdale. His father had been the first landscape architect in South Florida, and his mother was a landscape architect as well. They had graduated from the University of Illinois. And he'd come there to do landscape architecture. And there was Roy Pender, who was a year behind me. His father had been in the nursery business here in Raleigh. And Roy and I had gone to high school together. And he had gone there specifically for landscape architecture. And there were a couple others that were there, had enrolled in initially landscape architecture.
How were the projects different from architecture to landscape architecture?
The architectural studios in second year dealt with form follows function of the building. You were designing the function of the building in terms of layouts, of floor plans, and then let the exterior side come from what was happening inside. I know that first semester in architecture we had what they called the brick and tile competition, Sanford Brick Company would put on a competition, and all the second year students would enter. In that particular year, it was to design a pottery with kilns and everything. And one of my classmates, Gil Wheelis, won it with a beautiful design. But we had to, you know, the pottery had a certain function of where, when the clay came in and how it went through rollers and how it went to the design part and then how it got to the kiln and how it got to the showroom and so forth. So that ate up a lot of that semester's time of doing that particular project. And then the Landscape Architectural Studio concentrated more on environmental issues of how to deal with the land and what went on the land, how to sculpt and form the land for some of its best use while preserving and maintaining a lot of its natural resources. So we dealt a lot with that. And the time we were taking geology and botany and more of the natural sciences than the architects were taking more of the math and algebra and statics and statistics and mechanics and things like that.
With Lewis teaching the environmental aspects of landscape architecture, that's come down as a theory of landscape architecture, hasn't it?
Yeah, he brought it from his time at Harvard. Brian Hackett had brought it to Harvard from England. And at that time, there were two basic theories of landscape architecture being taught in the United States. It was the East Coast theory being taught by Harvard, which were the environmental process. And then there was the West Coast theory that was coming out of Berkeley, where Egbo, Dean, and Austin, and the Green and Green brothers, and everybody were doing. They were based a little on environmental, but not as much as the East Coast. And we were being taught a lot of the environmental side. Dealing with the natural resources, the water, conservation, let the land dictate where the buildings go rather than the buildings dictate how the land would be utilized.
So you started in 61, you're learning this environmental aspect theory in 62, 63,
yeah.
Right in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, 62, 63. Yeah, I started at State at 17 years old.
17?
Yeah. I turned 18 my freshman year there.
That was when it was good to turn 18, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was 62, 63. And then after second year, everybody was split up then into their chosen major. The architects went down the architectural road, the product designers went down the product design, visual design road, and the landscape architectural students went down more of an intense landscape architectural program. So we started third year, and you always had at least three or four classes in school design. You always had a design studio, which was where you worked on primarily design of projects and programs. You had a technical studio. The design studios were usually either 3 or 4 hours in third year, and your technical studio was usually an hour of class 3 days a week in a 3 hour studio lab. And then you had a drawing class. You could either be marble sculpture. And then we had some type of history class. In the first 2 years, it was taught. The history classes were all outside the school and were taught in the university's history departments. And it was basically history of Western civilization or American history. But starting in third year, we started getting into art history, and then later the history of architecture, and then history of landscape architecture, and so forth.
Were those some of the courses that Lewis was teaching, the history courses?
Lewis taught history of landscape architecture, I think, for about 2 years. Very good course. He was able to tie it to what was happening in the rest of the world and where it was within the world and within the time frames. So many of the other art history and history of architecture were memorization of slides. What was this? When was it? What significance did it have? And Lewis's courses were a lot more fun to take, and I think they retained a lot more.
Were you, so moving into your fourth year, is the four-year program, right?
Five-year.
Five-year program. Moving into your fourth and fifth year, did you start working on some of the projects outside of school that Lewis was starting to
have? Yeah. Midway December, during my third year, I needed a job during Christmas. And I asked Lewis if he needed anybody, and he sent me over to his office, which was over the old, what is now the old McDonald's on Hillsborough Street, to Charlie Burkett. Charlie and Warren Wilson and Henry Hammond were working for Lewis at that time in that office. They had just moved the office out of their house on Rockgip Road Drive up to there. And I think we had one, two, three, we had four rooms over there. And I went over and interviewed with Charles, and he hired me. So I went into basically that second semester of my that was my third year, December of my third year. I started doing base maps and running prints, and then I got to I think one of the first things I was working on was we were working for the Rouse Company out of Baltimore doing the Village of Cross Keys, and we had a lot of townhomes, very expensive townhomes that had gardens out back, and we wanted to develop a series of wooden fence designs and brick fence designs that would not be repetitive, that would be individual to each unit. So I must have designed 25 or 30 different fence designs for these. We were also working on New Hanover Memorial Hospital for Leslie Boney, who was an architect in Wilmington. And I started working on that with Henry Hammond. He was kind of the project manager for it. And we had to do all the stormwater calculations and the grading of it. I learned how to do all that in the office. And then I'd go to class 2 hours later, and we'd be taking it up in the class. And I'd already learned it in the office, so I was always in the landscape technology classes, I was always two or three pages or chapters ahead of what we were learning in school. I was had already done it in the office. But it was a very interesting time. I would work, I'd probably work 20 hours a week in the office. And maybe 24, 25, depending on the weekends, and keep up with my schoolwork.
Well, that was a job, wasn't it?
It was fun. It wasn't a job. It was fun. The whole thing about the school design back then was time management, how to learn to manage your time. And people would be over the school at 8 or 9 o'clock at night working on the projects, but there was a lot of horseplay going on. And there were several of us that would go home, get something to eat, and take a nap, and then we'd go back about 11, 11:30 when all the horseplay had shut down, when you could really, till 3 or 4 in the morning, you could get a lot done. And that's still the case for me today. I do most of my good design work late at night after the phone stopped ringing, and I fall through everything. We had another professor there who was head of the Department of Landscape Architecture. His name was Richard Moore. And between Richard and Lewis, it was just a dynamic duo of talent to be around and be exposed to some of the best things both of them ever taught me and my classmates was people would had the tendency to keep designing on yellow trash, keep redoing it right up to the last minute, and they could never finish a project. And they taught us to finish it, not to keep redoing it, but finish it, and then you could go back and refine it a little bit, but you had it finished, so it was ready to meet the deadline, and then you could refine it rather than keep designing right up to the last minute. I know we'd go in to hang our projects up for the critique, because we'd have every design problem, we'd have a series of faculty come in and critique our projects. And we had one guy, and he had designed and designed and designed right up to the last moment, and he had nothing except just these idea sketches, and so he just wadded them all up in a big ball and took a 10-penny nail and drove it into the crib. See, it's just a big wad of yellow trash. That's my project.
So they taught you to not do that, not go past your deadline.
Yeah, we used to have where we'd be in the middle of a project designing something. It's okay, today in today's studio, 4-hour studio, you've got 4 hours to design this problem. They'd hand out a new problem, and we'd have to come up with the idea, the concept, and the finished product within 4 hours. And it taught us to, you design within your time limits. Whatever you have, you've got to get it finished. The deadline's not going to be extended, particularly when you have clients and working under city, municipality deadlines and things like that. You've got to finish. So the critical things, and we had many of those types of exercises that really taught us to think fast and accept some decisions and move on with it. Because once you accept your one decision, you can move on to the next one, and you built your designs on those decisions. That was one of the most valuable lessons I took away from school. And we kept doing that. And this is planned by Lewis and Dick. I mean, they absolutely planned this into the curriculum. I mean, even up into fourth year, when Lewis would be teaching one studio and Dick would be teaching a technical studio, and they would assign two projects to be due on the same day, and it would be almost impossible to get them done. and do your other schoolwork. And I know they were both due the Monday after Thanksgiving. And so when we left on Tuesday before Thanksgiving, we basically had Lewis's design studio done. We hadn't even started on Dick's. Lewis's was a golf course kind of community. I forgot what Dick's was. Dick's was a housing project. And Dick came in the studio that afternoon. He said, "Guys, yeah, you better have some." So we were begging for an extension. He said, "I'm not giving an extension. You just, if you got between now and Monday, hung something up. Don't put me in a place where I have to give you y'all F's." So we worked the whole Thanksgiving. That we didn't get home. Worked the whole Thanksgiving, got something done. It wasn't what we wanted, but it was enough to satisfy the project's criteria. And we made decisions that, you know, we would have probably taken 2 days to refine, and we made them in like an hour. And we knew how much time we had, so rather than doing this a big rendering and a big fancy presentation, we cut it down. We did it at a smaller scale so we could do it and take less time to draw it at. Learned a lot of things like that.
These are really mature decisions that they're throwing at you at an undergraduate level, mm-hmm. right? Well, you mentioned Charlie Burkhead and Henry Hammond.
Yeah.
They're in school with you at the same time.
No, they had graduated.
They had graduated. So Henry, the office was actually going, a going concern at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, there were three people who had graduated. Warren Wilson, who had graduated from state. Charlie Burkhead, who had graduated from state and had gone on and gotten a master's degree at Harvard and then had come back. And he was working there with Lewis. And Henry Hammond, who had graduated from Georgia, who had moved to Raleigh. There were three different, all three of them were different. Charlie was kind of a project manager overall, kind of he ran the office. Henry was more of a technical-oriented person, dealing with grading and drainage and roadway layout and things like that. Warren was the pure designer and the plantsman. He would end up doing all the planting plans, and he and Charlie would come up with the design concepts with Lewis. And then they would go their separate ways and work on the projects. It was an interesting office.
After you graduated, did you start working full time?
Yeah, I worked with Lewis all through third, fourth, and fifth year. And then went to work with him full time after I graduated. And by then it was just, Henry had left, Warren had left and gone to Oklahoma City, which is where he was from. And so it was Charlie and I. And then we started hiring some more of the students. I'm trying to think if initially, we had Ken Sangster, who graduated a year or two ahead of me and had gone to work in Norfolk and had come back. He had come into the office. And then we had a couple of students that were in fourth and fifth year that were working there. Don Basil, Sally Shulman, Roy Pender. Wayne McBride had come into the office at that time. So we probably had Fred Tressaw had come into the office for a while. Fred was in was fifth year with me. And almost everybody else was, Sanctuary was 2 years ahead of us. And almost everybody else were fourth year or 1 or 2 years behind us.
So was the office still located on Hillsborough Street?
Yeah, we had moved it. Lewis and Kid had bought an old house right across from the English building on Hillsborough Street. Halfway between Enterprise and the street that forked, that comes out.
Overland?
It was north of Overland, right across from the English building, English Park. It was eventually torn down. But anyway, we took that house and turned the second floor into the studio. And the first floor was the accounting office and Lewis's office and a conference room and a reception area for the secretary and a kitchen area in the back. And upstairs, we had kind of gutted it and turned it into a, we had a big, crib conference room that was all wall gallery where we could hang the big projects up and show them to clients and crit them ourselves. We went through it, and then we had two back rooms that were all drafting studio, design studio and stuff. And I think when we moved into that house, we had, we had Lewis and Kit and Lib, who was the secretary, and Lewis, that was four downstairs. And we had a print errand guy, who was Richard Lee, started out in high school. You know, went to school design, but he's now is a landscape architect, back he's chairman of the landscape architectural board. And then we had one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Now we had about 10 combination landscape architects and students.
That's a big staff.
Yeah, we had a big staff.
Well, you must have been working on big projects.
We had started getting we always had fairly larger projects. Lewis for years had been doing the Rouse Company's work for Bill and Jim Rouse. And I think we had, about the time we moved into the house, we had just finished up basically all our malls. We were doing some preliminary work on Plymouth Meeting in Springfield, Massachusetts. But we weren't doing what we usually do. We just did some concept stuff. And they had started, the Rouse Company had started some preliminary design work on their new town outside of Baltimore. And we were doing some preliminary concepts for them. They had built their kind of their own staff.
That's Columbia.
Columbia, yeah. And the Rouse Boys had built kind of their own in-house staff. And they used us to give them some ideas on how to do some stuff. But about that time, we also were doing we'd gotten into a lot of schoolwork. We did a lot of the state had developed a large community college program, and we were doing a lot of community colleges. We were doing a lot of work with Tommy Hayes. Hayes Howell out of Southern Pines, schools, high schools, and banks, and large residential work for Tommy. And for Leslie Boney out of Wilmington, we were doing a lot of community colleges and hospitals and high schools. We did Hoggard High School with Leslie. We did. We've done the what's the school in the Methodist school outside of Fayetteville?
Larimer. St. Andrews.
St. Andrews. We've done the master plan for that. And we had done the master plan. We're working on the master plan for Sand Hills Community College for Hayes. We were doing Hoggard High School, as I said, with Leslie. We were doing Richmond Technical Institute for Leslie Bone. That was down in Rockingham. And we were doing Rockingham Community College for Leslie up in Reedsville, Isle Thermal up in the mountains, Asheville, Volcom Institute, which became Asheville, UNC Asheville. We did the master plan for that. Vance Community College.
Was UNC Charlotte in there?
We did some dorm expansion. When they wanted to build the dorms, we did the master plan area for the dorms for Charlotte, as I recall. I don't think we did a lot. We did the law school campus at the University of Virginia. We did Patrick Henry Community College in Virginia. We did James Mason Community College in Virginia, because when they found out how North Carolina was doing, Virginia started their program and they started using us to work with them up there.
So you're still in the house on Hillsborough Street this time?
Yeah, still in the house on Hillsborough Street.
And was there an airplane involved in this mix?
I think about that time, Lewis and
Ezra
Meyer, a structural engineer, had gotten together. We worked on a project together, and they decided we'd buy an airplane together. And so they did. They bought a push-pull, a 337 Cessna, which has an engine in the front, engine in the back, an overhead wing. It would hold five people plus a pilot. And it was one of the safest airplanes in the world. And you could land and take off on very short runways. And a lot of our projects were in areas where we needed to fly into grass strips, so we could get to them quicker. It was, sometimes it was economically feasible, and other times it was just fun to have.
Just fun?
Fun to have. And
and the pilot's name was Rooney?
Rooney. He was our full-time pilot. And he was a retired lieutenant colonel from the Air Force. And he became kind of a personnel manager in the office and our pilot. He took care of people and our office cars and made sure they all got serviced properly. And it became really very invaluable. Let's see, about that time, this is 69, I left Lewis.
Well, let me just stop you for a minute. Okay. Before you leave, Lewis, because in 1968, Palmetto Dunes project,
right,
came in.
Right.
So I was wanting you to say something about Palmetto Dunes.
Yeah, we got our first two large resort residential golf course communities. First one was Palmetto Dunes down on Hilton Head Island by a group out of Greenwood, South Carolina, a bunch of doctors and investors, and we started designing that. And I think at the time, when I worked on that, we worked on it for about 2 years. We were one of the first people, I mean, we brought an entomologist on board because of the insect mosquito problems. We've all brought an ecologist on board because of the sensitive environmental issues down there. We were probably one of the first people in the nation to ever, I mean, everybody used aerial photography. And we did take the aerial photography of the island that would show the bodies of waters, and then we take the survey that the surveyors did, and we'd overlay those so we could see where the vegetation was. And where it was difficult to see where wetlands were, and there weren't anything about wetlands back then, except they was just wet land. There weren't any rules about it or anything, and we just tried to stay out of it and preserve it as much as possible. So we, the Research Triangle Institute, the director out there was a friend of ours, and they were first people using Landsat satellite imagery. And they went out, they showed us how they were doing it. And they had these huge computers, nothing that we could use. And at that time, we were doing no computers. We didn't have a computer in the office. And for years, we didn't have computers. We were doing everything manually. But what we learned from the Research Triangle Institute was that we would use infrared satellite imagery that we could purchase, and we put that down on the drawing board and overlay the topography and the aerial, because we get all those in clear mylars, and the infrared would show you where the wet land was because it came up with a different intensity of color. And in fact, we used it an awful lot because you could take an infrared photograph, and if you could identify one item on that photograph that you knew was a building or a parking lot or a lake because of the different intensity of color, then you knew what all the land uses were in, say, a county or a large area tract of land, something.
So this was an innovation. This was a huge innovation.
Yeah. In fact, the RTP, what they do is they put the Landsat things come down on their computers and look, it'll be a little computer screen like this, and then they take slides of them, and then they project slides onto these big glass screens. It would be glass, and they put paper behind it and project the slide up on the glass, and then you go stand behind the glass and you trace it off backwards on the back side.
No kidding.
Yeah. And in fact, Dick Moore's office was about right down the block, built one of those in his office, so we could go down and use his thing to do that with slides.
I didn't realize Dick Moore had an office at the same time.
Yeah, he had an office next to the PR around the corner, and the house is still there. It's Sam and Bill's, at least it used to be there. It was Sam, it turned into Sam and Bill's haircut place.
Oh, yeah.
We got the head of the product design department at State was hired on, Don Masterton, and he came up with the logo for Palmetto Dunes and came up with the first stationery and everything, so we were doing all the graphics. We were composing the design guideline booklet for Palmetto Dunes and writing it, as well as doing the master plan and all the first phase construction of it. We designed everything in detail from the entrance road back to the north. And then everything on the south we left, we had design ideas for, but we recommended to the clients that they hold off on that because the market was going to change so much that there was no reason that was going to be a much higher density product over there than single family residential and some villas that we were doing over on the north side. And they did hold off on it, and eventually it became very high density development with three or four hotels and a lot more condominiums and two more golf courses. We hired Dr. Per Brun from Norway, who had worked on the Amsterdam canals and locks. Palmer Dunes had a terrible beach erosion problem. They were losing 3 feet of beachfront a year. So we had to build a protected dune along the ocean. And in order to get the material, the earthwork, to build this dune, we had to dig some canals. And so we just said, well, every lot in Palmer Dunes will either be on a golf course or on a lot, on a canal. And so all the canals were connected, and they went across the highway to the north side into the Calaboy Sound, and the Sound had a 8-foot tidal differentiation. So Dr. Brun designed these flap gates that are right at where the canal goes under the roadway on the Palmetto Dunes side, where we could cut down the tidal. The canal water fluctuates only 6 inches, 6 inches up, 6 inches down. And also this way we could flush the canals out by opening the gates and letting the water come through and flush it all the way back out and let it go back out. So you wouldn't have stagnant water that would have present mosquito problems. So we'd always have flow in there. We wouldn't have still water, which the entomologists really encouraged. We also designed an amphibious golf cart where everybody could purchase one, and you could actually use that in the canals. And then when you came out of the canal and drove it up onto your lot, we had special irrigation and tracks that they came out on where the irrigation would spray up under the side because this was brackish water. It had a lot of salt in it, and it would kill the grass. So you wanted to get all the salt off of it. And so then it could dry all around the course. They never marketed and never manufactured. I don't think they ever built one of them, but it's in the drawings. It's kind of a neat concept. And Palmetto Dunes was on the ocean side. It was all basically residential with golf courses and one or two restaurants and one or two major hotels. And we had envisioned the Marriott, the Radisson, which is there now. We envisioned that the canal would run through the lobby of the hotel. Well, the hotel didn't want to do that, so it ran in front of the hotel, and you had to have to drive over it to get to it. And I think we were one of the first people to use the roundabouts outside of the people in Pinehurst. We thought that roundabout was a good solution to that down there.
This is the reason that I asked you about Palmetto Dunes also, is that for a landscape architect's office, this is quite a few people to put together. I mean, Today you wouldn't normally expect the landscape architect to be the point person for all these experts.
That's true. It's one of the first projects where the landscape architect was the chief designer and not an architect. In fact, there wasn't an architect on board in any of our events. They had a local architect that when we wanted some concepts, when they got into designing specific things like the villas themselves, or taking our sketches of what the gatehouse needed to look like, he lived on the island. He did those for them. But that was after the master plan had been done and approved and everything. But no, we had we hired the engineers. We hired the we developed the worked with the engineers to come up with a vacuum sewer system to sewer the project.
That was Bob Browning, right?
He was our engineer consultant here in Raleigh. There were, ended up being some other engineers down there that were had specialties that we used. But basically everybody was on our staff, and we were controlling what they did and how they did it and how they presented it. One of the first times outside of probably Charlie Frazier, who developed sea pines on Hilton Head. He had done that initially. He was the client, but he was such so far ahead. I mean, he controlled all the designers and everything. He had Sasaki had done sea pines, and they had done that the same way, where they controlled everything in Frazier. But Frazier had his home office at Sea Pines, and he had a huge staff there, landscape architects and designers.
So it was the era of large offices, would you say?
It was an area of small offices, I think, that were growing to medium-sized offices. My theory was that once you got to five in an office, you needed to get to 25. Once you got to 25, you needed to be 100. Anything in between, from 5 and 25, was not economically profitable. You didn't make any more money than you did with five people. At 25, between 25 and 100, you didn't make any more money in that in-between era. So a lot of offices that, I mean, probably at the end of Palmetto Dunes, that thing we had dug out the basement in the old house, and we had two design studios downstairs with probably six people in each. So we were probably 25 people at that time. And we had picked up another large project called Caroline Trace down at Sanford that we were working on as we were finishing up Palmetto Dunes. We were working on another large project in Southern Pines. But Dan Farrell, he and Robert Trent Jones owned a piece of land together, and we were designing a golf course community on it. It never was built. I think it's now, he sold the land, and I think it became what is called the Pitt Golf Course down there now. But then we got A.B. Hardy had us, who owned Richmond Pines. He had bought a large tract of land with backed by a lot of supposedly Hollywood investors out of California, and he was going to do the artificial wave lake down there that never got off the ground, but the golf course did. I think what we did, it was called Lake Surf. I think it's now called Seven Lakes or something. But you know, towards the 68, 69, we had a really lot of large projects in the office. We also had In fact, I was in the office one day, and the phone rang, and I answered it. And this gentleman says, "Can I speak to Mr. Lewis or Mr. Clark?" And I said, "Well, you can't speak to either one of them because they're both the same person. And he's not here right now, but I'm Lamar Bunn. Can I help you?" And it happened to be Ted Lerner of Lerner Companies out of Washington, D.C. He said, "Are you the group that did Cherry Hill Mall for the Rouse?" And I said, "Yes, sir, we are." He said, "Well, I'm doing a mall called Tyson's Corner outside of Washington, on the west side of Washington, and with Lathrop Douglas, who's the architect. And we'd like for y'all to come up and talk to us about being our landscape architects. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Yes, sir. What day you want us there?" He said, "Well, I was thinking about Friday." And I said, "Well, let's tentatively schedule it for Friday. We'd fly up on the early morning flight and rent a car. You'll tell me where we're meeting." And he said, "We'll meet in our offices at Wheaton Plaza out in Wheaton on the north side." So I found out where that was. And Lewis was in class. He was teaching class, I think. It was shortly after that that he resigned. But we flew up, did an interview, got that job, and this was a huge, and it was a 1.2 million square feet of enclosed mall and shopping center. So we added that to our palette, and then Robert Trent Jones got us a couple of jobs. He had a piece of land outside west of Montclair where these two new interstates were interchanging, it was going to be. There was a small university there, and he wanted to develop a town center. And so we flew up to Montclair. I took, Lewis says, "Who do you want to take?" And I said, "I want to take Stressall, Basil, and myself." And so Lewis and I, we flew up, and we stayed up there for 4 days and designed the whole thing there in their conference room. Also, we picked up the Montclair Tennis Club facility up there, which we hired an architect to design the building and did the facility up there. So, you know, we were flying back and forth to Washington and flying the push pool up to Montclair, New Jersey. And,
well, that solves the riddle of how did you do so many projects in such a large geographical area, because they were at the same time, like you say, there was projects from close by and mm-hmm. far away. So the airplane was the clue. How unusual was it for y'all to have the airplane? Did other companies have airplanes at that time?
No. Leslie Boney had a limousine with a chauffeur, and Lewis always wanted, he always wanted a limousine with a chauffeur, and I think that's what sparked, he could tell Leslie, "Well, I've got an airplane with a pilot." that was analogous to Leslie's, because Leslie would always show up on project sites with us, and we'd fly a plane in, and Leslie would drive in with a chauffeur, and so that was always kind of, at least my couple of us on the staff, we always just said, "Okay, well, this is Lewis's chauffeur and limousine." But it made it convenient. I remember even later on when we got the 421, which was a much larger, quicker plane. But I remember one night we'd gone up to Montclair, New Jersey, we got snowed in. He couldn't get out. And the next morning at 6 a.m., we're out there chipping ice off the wings so we can get out. And that was the day that all the airplanes in LaGuardia in Newark made the front page of Life magazine, because they were backed up on the runways and in the taxiways, and so many planes grounded, it made the front page. And our little plane took off from Montclair, New Jersey, and flew back to Raleigh. We got out before all those planes started eating up the airway. But it was the same weekend.
It was a close call, wasn't it?
Oh, it was so cold in that little plane. I remember we're flying back, and it's like 6 in the morning, and we had not had much sleep. Rooney was flying. And Sally Shawman was with me, and I think Don Basil, and we found, we always had a bar in the back. We always take one seat out for our luggage, and Jerry always had a portable bar. It would have a bottle of scotch and a bottle of vodka. And we found the bottle of scotch, and that's what all three of us drank. We took the top off of that bottle of scotch. It was so cold, we drank it all the way back to Raleigh.
Well, I want to change direction just a little bit and ask you some things about Lewis.
Okay.
What kind of boss was he?
He was an excellent boss. He let everybody in the office design the projects. He wasn't an overbearing designer, and he kind of ran the office like he ran the studio in school. He'd come by and check on every project and critique it with everybody, and then once a week we'd have each project, we'd hang up on the boards and we'd have everybody come in and critique it and go over the ideas of what's good, what's wrong, what we need to change, and things like that. And every now and then Lewis would, particularly when the office was smaller, he'd get on the boards and design, do the quick yellow trash sketches and stuff, and then turn it over to somebody like me to turn it into a final master plan. And but later on, as we got much larger, you know, he couldn't do that. He missed doing it, and every now and then he'd put a piece of yellow trash up on the wall and resketch how this needed to be. But he was a very, very good boss, a very good mentor. I don't remember many jealousies. He was always interested in quality and design and the quality that we produced. I remember we had done Pinecrest High School with Tommy Hayes, and it was on a terrible sloping piece of ground. And so we had talked the architect into putting the building on a plinth, the school buildings on a plinth, and building this big wall around where we let the slope come into it and come off of it. And then the athletic fields were way up, about 10 feet above the school. Up here we had a big bank coming down. And I'd done all the design work and all the grading and everything. And it was probably one of my second projects out of school. And they'd had a big rain. And they had on one of the banks, running down the school from the playfields, we'd had a big erosion wipeout, huge gully, about 10 feet wide and about 10 feet deep. And we'd go up there to look at it, because the architect, since that was our side of the project, and he wanted us to pay for the corrections of it. And I'll never forget that I'm out there and I'm scared to death. First time I've ever had anything like that happen. So Lewis is out there, and Lewis jumps down in this washout. And he turns around and looks and says, "Ah, it's just a bit of erosion." Like it's no big deal. And it cost us $1,000 to have it re-ditched and redone and put a new ditch in.
So he didn't come down on your head like some bosses would do.
No. And he just said, "Well, we learned a lesson today." I said, "Yeah, you can't sheet drain that much in your land."
Well, what made the associates' designs different from other landscape architects?
I really think that in the beginning years, that what made that office unique and different was that everybody had some input into the design. It wasn't just one person. And even later, when it was divided into four or five teams, they worked on this project. That project was always put up in the crit room, and everybody else in the office had critique and input into it. And I think that's what made it very unique and different than all the other offices that I was aware of. And that was always encouraged. And I don't think, except maybe once or twice, I don't think anybody took it personally or looked at it as a affront to them personally. And a lot of times it happened when this person would say, "Hey, I need y'all to take a look at this kind of direction I'm looking at." And we might go down and get Lewis and say, "Lewis, I need you 3 o'clock this afternoon to come upstairs. We're going to go over where we are on this before we get too far along, make sure we're all on the same page and we haven't overlooked something." And that's where the office developed. Because I know that sometimes you get so, when we were designing Tyson's Corner Mall, Fred was designing some of the benches to be hung on the walls, and the benches had to be cantilevered out from the wall so that the maintenance people could sweep up under it and get all the trash, and then the wall had to come down and have a curved tile down to the floor, so the trash wouldn't gather in those corners and they could easily be maintained. And Fred got into using a lot of metal and welding things together for this bench. And I stood by his desk one day and I said, "Fred, why can't we just do that out of wood?" And he, like a light went off in his head, and he says, "You're right, we can. We have the cost." And those are the kind of things.
So just a lot of collaboration.
Yeah. And it was a good group of people that weren't I don't think we're envious or jealous of each other. Huge, huge amount of talent. I can't imagine an office in 69 having more talent than we had in that office. Unbelievable.
Well, let me ask you, how did what you learned from Lewis in school and in the office, how did that affect your practice when you started your own practice?
I did it much the same way. The hardest thing was finding the talent. Back then, the talent was just oozing out of the school design. When I started my own practice, it was just difficult to find talented people. So I had to keep a much closer rein on the design quality in the preliminary design work, and make sure that the people I had hired didn't screw it up. And I think the difference was the lack of talent in the marketplace. Back with Lewis, we'd all been through the same program. We knew what everybody else, we knew what everybody that was working under us knew, and they knew what we knew. And the only difference would be is, I might have 2 years experience working out where they had just graduated, but I knew what they had been through and I knew what they could do. Where in 70, when I started my first office, I didn't know what these other people had done. I didn't have any clue. And so it was me learning what they could do and what they couldn't do. And it was a lot of trial and error.
How has landscape architecture changed since you were in school?
Ooh. Was I told somebody the other day, I am so glad that I am in the twilight of my career rather than the renaissance of it. Because landscape architecture had changed to where now it's almost all big offices, and they're multi-discipline offices, usually run by architects and engineers. There are a few large landscape architectural firms around the country. But it's become quantitative rather than qualitative. All municipalities now run by people that think they can design, and all they want, and all the rules and regulations now are about numbers, and doesn't have anything to do with quality. They have passed rules and regulations and codes and text changes and zoning now to where you can't do a uniquely great design project. Everything is set up that you do mediocrity, medium projects. And that is so you won't get a real bad one. If you set codes up so you don't get real bad ones, then you eliminate your real good ones. And it's really a shame.
Is it a field to go into these days?
I wouldn't recommend it. I told my daughter not. I didn't want her going into it. And with the computerization,
well, it's not a craft anymore, is what you're saying.
It's not art.
Mm.
I mean,
it's just changed completely, right?
Yeah.
Just changed. What's the one important thing to know about Lewis Clark?
He's a Pisces.
What's the one important thing to know about Lamar Bunn?
He's a Leo.
Well, do you have anything else you'd like to tell us today?
Lewis was for me almost a father image. I know I learned everything about landscape architecture from him and two of my classmates.
And which two classmates were those?
Gil Wheelis and Fred Stressel. I used to tell my students when I taught, and then my employees, I said, do it the way I do it until you've learned it, and then until you can do it better than I can. And that was my concept with Lewis, is I wanted to copy what he was doing till I learned to be able to do it, and then be able to do it better than him. I mean, he used to come in and somebody else in the office, was project was in trouble or something, he'd say, Lamar, come here, and he'd bring it over to my desk, he says, here, you got 2 hours, do your thing on this. Use your orange markers. Because I used to do, I'd lay out lots and subdivisions with a freehand and color in the different size lots with orange and blue and different colors. In fact, even today, I can take a subdivision layout, lay out the roads, and they're perfect curves freehand. And Lewis did the same thing. I remember back in the early 70s, Lewis was he was worried about because we were getting so much licensure everywhere. And he just had a grandfather license here in North Carolina. And in some states that wouldn't surpass. And he was, because I had been president of CLARP, he started talking to me about, should he go through the CLARP process? And I said, Lewis, that's a pain in the ass process to go through. I said, just go take the damn exam. He said, I couldn't pass the exam. What the hell, you can't? I said, you taught history. History's the hardest thing on there. Go back and read your old notes, your class notes, and you can design anything. You and Dick Moore are the two quickest people on the drawing board I've ever seen. And I'm probably the third quickest. And Stressall is right behind us. I said, you can design anything. It's just do it. And think he looked at what he had to go through with Clark and said, "You're right, I'm going to take the exam." I said, "You sign up for it, you go take it, it's 3 days, you're over with. Clark is a, it'll take you a year to get all that shit together." And of course, you know, everybody was just shocked when he walked into the exam that day. I think I was monitoring it the first day. And I just told him, I said, "Relax, it's just like going to the office and doing it." I said, "You know how to do it." So he passed with flying colors. So once he passed that, I mean, he'd get a license anywhere in the state.
And CLARB was the, what did that stand for?
The Council of Landscape Architectural Registration Boards. It's a, it's made up of all the licensing boards from all states that have licenses. CLARB is responsible for providing the uniform exam to each of the states, and then grading it and keeping up with the records of the candidates. And
well, that's another difference between what, how things used to be and now, is the licensing and continuing education requirement.
That's really been a benefit. That's helped establish a standard, a uniform standard across the country to improve the practice of landscape architecture. And requiring continuing education, it's a pain in the butt, but it, you know, for example, I'm licensed in North Carolina and Florida. And I very seldom go to any of the North Carolina continuing education things because I think they're about 3 or 4 years behind what Florida's going through. And so I go every year to Florida and go through 3 days of their continuing education down there, and they have some of the best classes that deal with the environmental problems, the water problems that we're having here, the stormwater problems that we're dealing with here now. I mean, I've already been through classes and dealt with that 4 years ago. And I just got back from Florida last month, and they're dealing with one of their big issues right now is the hurricanes. And we have a big problem with hurricanes in North Carolina as well. But we're not teaching anything on continuing education as it relates to landscape architecture about that. But I think it's a good thing. I mean, Lewis was one of the first people to help get the, he and Dick Bell helped to get the licensure here in North Carolina. I don't know what his license number is. I think it's either 2, 3, or 4.
Well, I think he delayed. He was hard-headed about it. He delayed just a little bit. I think actually Charlie Burkhead has a lower number than he does.
Does it?
Mm-hmm. I think he's number 11.
11?
I'm not sure.
He probably just, well, I know he worked hard to get it. I think Dick Bell had number 1. I've got 55, so.
Do you know how many there are now? As a compare, it's in the hundreds, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would think it would be over 1,000.
Really? In North Carolina?
Yeah. I know my Florida one I got in 71, 701.
Wow.
And I think there's, they're into the five figures. I think I got 10, 11,000.
Well, that's all the questions I have for you today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, just anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, there are a couple things. I mean, we always, in the office, most of the of us were Lewis's students, and we'd always kind of joke about that Lewis taught us the yellow trash and the five senses. Roll of yellow trash and the five senses. That's all you need to do to design landscape architecture. And we always kid each other about that. And I always kid him back. I said, well, I'm going to write a book one day. And we call yellow trash and six senses. I said, what's the six sense? I said, common sense.
Oh, that's good.
And but he was, Lewis, being a Pisces, always tried to figure out everybody. And he would utilize this person based on this astrology against this person, and which ones would needed to butt heads at times and which ones needed to complement each other at times. And he was a master of that.
And, so you're saying he used astrology?
Yeah, I think so. Very definitely. And he was a master at being Piscean and working that little magic with the staff and knowing which projects to put who on. But we used to always tell him, said Lewis, when we're in the airplane, you can only fly in the right seat, you can't fly in the left seat. He said, why? It's because the insurance won't pay for us if you're in the left seat.
That's a good enough reason. Okay, Lamar, I think we'll close with that. It's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.